I can't get you out of my head now. Next time, like today, when I'm at the store swiping my credit card, I'm gonna hear you echoing like, "This debt will make you die."
Yeah, you said it. I'm just echoing what you said to me.
This podcast contains the arguably witty banter of two friends, Skippy and Doodles, that like to debate about investing. The content is intended to be entertaining and for informational purposes only, not investment advice. You should do your own research and consult a financial professional before using any of the information in this podcast, and especially before investing.
When's the last time you ate pizza?
Last time I ate pizza?
Yeah.
Oh, man, that's a good question. I feel like it was pretty recent. It was in the last couple weeks because I was put in charge of dinner. She went out with a friend, and she goes, I'm feeling kind of hungry. I'm heading home, you know, get some dinner going. Boom. Open up my phone. Domino's on the way. Got all the food groups. Got the fruit and the tomatoes. Got that dairy with the cheese. Got the bread going on. Boom. Nailed it. Nailed dinner. You know how long it took me? You know, I know. You know how long it took to get to my house?
No, that's a more interesting question. Yeah,
22 minutes.
You did not actually time this.
It's like 22 minutes. Yeah, to get to my house. They best be getting there. I've been trained by the nose. That's what I call it, is the nose. I've been trained by the nose that they better be getting there in less than 30 minutes because I'm a kid of the 80s. If y'all didn't know, let me give you a couple little facts. And then I want to read. Let me circle back. There's this piece in The Hustle about Domino's and the 30-minute delivery. And I'm going to educate y'all right quick on this. Domino's, I didn't know this, was founded in 1960. I would have definitively guessed it was sometime after that, but like the 70s, like not just 60 just seems like a long time ago. Domino's was founded in 1960. And from the get, they had this minimalist inside the restaurant take so that it wasn't about coming in and sitting down and eating pizza. They focused on delivery. After a couple decades, that really started to catch on. And according to this piece, it was when women started going more heavily back into the workplace. And so, therefore, the convenience and quickness of meals, microwave became more popular, all this stuff. So, in the 1980s, Domino's was like, delivery has been our jam, and we will hammer that home with the masses. And their founder and CEO at this time, he said, he goes, look, I have timed this. We are so efficient in our cooking practices, and I know where people's be ordering from. And so on average, I see that it takes 28 minutes for us to get to a spot. Yeah. Let's guarantee this. Made the 30-minute guarantee. If your pizza, if you order a pizza from Domino's for delivery, and that pizza does not arrive at your spot, this is back in the mid-1980s, that pizza does not arrive at your spot within 30 minutes, that joint is free. That's where it started.
Absolutely insane. But I love every aspect of this. One, I remember it. Like it's a truly memorable promise. Two, Domino's annual revenue went from about 150 million in 1967 to almost 6 billion 10 years later. Right?
Those are big numbers.
They were doing something, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
The pizza is edible now. It was no, not even good. I wasn't gonna say good, but but it wasn't any good back then. It was effectively, I mean, me and my siblings had jokes about cardboard. We were effectively, you could not tell if you were eating the pizza or the cardboard back in 1986 when it showed up at your doorstep. But it was fast.
It was fast, and the 30-minute guarantee. This is why you said, did you really time it? It's like the 30-minute guarantee, to your point, is still up in my mentals. Like that's a thing, because it was, there's something about the exact timing of the 30 minutes that I don't know that I think can go here or there, but it was something that you know was going to be quick, like because of that guarantee, you know they're incentivized to do it. So this is what happened. Incentives. Charlie Munger and Skippity Doodah always talking about incentives. If you look in 1982, the percentage of deliveries that were made in 30 minutes or less from Domino's was 80%. It's pretty good. 1984, 89%. 1987, 95%. That's the power of incentives. If you're giving away pizzas for free, and your general managers know that, therefore your drivers know that, the incentives cascade down, people start getting better at it. This can only go well, right? Wrong. Incorrect that this could only go well. Now I'm going to read you a paragraph, or maybe a couple paragraphs. This is what actually starts the piece, but I wanted to give a little context first. I'm going to read this verbatim. In October 1985, a teenage Domino's driver was handed a pizza for delivery just outside Pittsburgh. It had been 23 minutes since the customer placed the order. He needed to hurry. He accelerated out of the restaurant parking lot and, without yielding, plowed into the car of Frank and Mary Jean Kranick, who suffered injuries. In the moments following the accident, a Domino's manager allegedly grabbed the pizza from the driver and passed it to another delivery worker with a message: there's still time.
Incentives.
So lawsuits abound, right? This was happening left, right, and center. There were some accidentes. According to this piece, they were comparing the injury rate, or it could have been fatality rate, it's one of the two, I can't remember, of the Domino's delivery driver to a coal mine worker. That's not a comparison you want. So lawsuits abound. Then finally, in 1993, there was a big case settled, and they changed the policy. So no more 30-minute guarantee.
Yes, because Domino's was found liable for millions of dollars worth of damages. Now, you go back, I used to deliver pizza. So yeah, I know what it's like to be stressed.
I
was at the competitor. I was at Pizza Hut, right? Made in the shade over there. My sweet time.
3 hours or less.
3 hours or less. I will tell you that even 30 minutes or less seemed a little insane working for a competitor. The guarantee was not in place at this point because this is after 1993. But depending on staffing issues, how busy the oven is, how busy the restaurant is, sometimes 30 minutes did just not seem feasible. It was, I mean, it goes back to the joke about the pizza being bad. I think they built the whole franchise around quick.
Yeah,
that's right. Almost nothing else.
That's right. And they switched that up. When was it? It was in the last like 10 years or so, I feel like, that they decided to make the pizza good. Pretty recent.
It was within the past 10 years. Yeah.
So the last piece I'll touch on. After this policy was changed, it had an unintended consequence. The intended consequence was no more 30-minute guarantee. People can not plow into folks when they're coming out of Domino's. The unintended consequence is that baseline personal insurance policies stopped covering drivers who use their car for business purposes. So now folks probably know, if any of y'all have been or are a Uber driver, Lyft driver, or other gig worker that uses a car, if you have one of those, you know that there's separate insurance that you would need to get in order for you to be covered during certain times of the usage of your car. You know this, and that's because of this.
I did not know that.
Mm. Yes. I did a little Ubering about 12 years ago. Yeah, and I remember this. I can't remember exactly when the coverage happens. I think it's during a ride. So like when you have a passenger in your car, I think that Uber or Lyft, their insurance covers you. But when you're going to pick someone up or when you're not, like that's not covered by anything. Unless you have a rider on your insurance policy. Now is the creme de la creme. And so now, like, what are injury rates looking like today? Today, for every 100 full-time workers in food delivery on your bike, we got 32 injuries. A third. Food delivery in a car, 12 injuries, 12%. That compares to nursing assistants, which is 10%. Construction workers is 2%. So you're six times as likely to get an injury delivering food in a car than you are if you were a construction worker.
Doesn't that kind of make sense?
It makes sense in that when I drive past construction sites, I don't see a lot of people working.
You went there. Have you ever seen the movie Quicksilver with Kevin Bacon?
I don't think so.
Okay. He's this is homework for our listeners because I love this movie. He's a halftime stockbroker, halftime bike delivery boy in San Francisco in 1985.
Makes perfect sense. Yeah.
Most bizarre movie you're ever going to see. I don't know that I could wholeheartedly recommend it, but man, is it something. It's a very unique concept. Yeah, that delivering anything is dangerous because it puts you in harm's way at peak times. Like that's when people need
stuff, that's right.
Right?
That's right.
And so it's kind of the reason you get paid for it is because there's an aspect of danger to it. I totally believe it.
What's in the fishbowl?
Well, you're going to talk about debt. You're going to talk about consumer debt.
And I am.
That's just because you're you. So I'm going to use this opportunity to go on a little tangent. I discovered a guy, and I know very little about him. You know, let's take a roller coaster to get here. In today's world of Rotten Tomatoes and really thorough book reviews and everything, sometimes I find myself doing pre-research before I consume the media that I'm ready to consume. And then that like spoils things because you either know if you're going to like it or if you're not going to like it because so you just dive in.
Yeah. I don't like watch the trailer beforehand unless I'd accidentally seen it in a preview for a movie before. I don't read about the. I get the book because I use Libby. Get the book in my Libby. I don't even know what it is or why it came to me, but I knew at some point I decided to read it.
Well, so this is great because I think there's actually power in that, and not always having a book show up on your doorstep that's like been pre-consumed by the crowd you run with that you're gonna like, right? It's like, oh, here's some different ideas. So I came across this guy, Kent Nerburn, this week. And I came across him through Morgan Housel with a couple quotes. And oh my goodness, Dougals. I'm gonna spend some time and go read you some quotes and then I'm gonna tell you about a book I read because of it. So
Kent Nerburn.
Kent Nerburn.
Okay.
First quote: debt defines your future, and when your future is defined, hope begins to die. Maybe a little extreme.
I mean, okay.
I love it. I love it. I'm going to keep going. There are massive forces in the world that tell you the great benefits of debt. They will tell you that by borrowing, you establish legitimacy in the eyes of lenders. They will tell you that you can have tomorrow's pleasure at today's prices. They will dress debt up in a suit and call it credit. But when it all comes down to the same thing. You have mortgaged your future to pay for the present, and this is something you never want to do.
It's the absolutes of it are deep, like death, never. That's deep stuff.
This comes from a book called Letters to My Son. It's exactly what you would expect. Okay. A new father writes a book. It has a chapter on war, a chapter on love, a chapter on spirituality, like everything.
Yeah.
It's just an older man trying to translate some things. And this chapter on money and debt is super short. I mean, it's 10 pages or something. He obviously has strong conviction about this. And I think the thing that really resonated with me, one, it's pretty extreme language. But when he ties basically making a decision, debt to sacrificing your future, there is something to that, right? And take it in a more acceptable lens, like buying a house, right? When you buy a house and you take out a 30-year mortgage, that's probably, for most people, a good trade of today's pleasures versus tomorrow's payments.
Yeah.
But it does also say, I better be committed to live in this place. Maybe not for 30 years, but for more than
a decade,
a year, you know, like,
yeah.
I just really enjoyed the way he talks about debt. I think it's great. And the book is also pretty solid too. The book will make you think through a lot of concepts in deep and profound ways. Good stuff.
You said Letters to My Son? That's what it's called?
Letters to My Son, yes.
Okay. Yeah, this is short. So is the chapter, it says, Take Out Debt and Die by NVIDIA? Is that the whole chapter on money?
Did you see the buzz going around this week? There's someone, and there's probably more than someone, but a couple folks that have officially sold their house to buy the dip with Tesla to live in their Tesla cars.
I got to reach into the fishbowl with this one. I can't even, I can't even engage.
It's not worth talking about. Good.
No.
Because it's not.
Especially because, according to the New York Times, we are at a point where mortgages are too good right now for people to give up their homes. The title of this, "A Huge Number of Homeowners Have Mortgage Rates Too Good to Give Up." That's the title of this piece in the New York Times. Okay. I hadn't thought about it in these terms before. Maybe you had. And so I found this to be an interesting spot. What this piece looked at was current average mortgage rates, which we've talked about in the past, and looking at the difference between existing mortgages and then what the rates on new homes are.
Yeah.
And what percent of the population is in like the low rate. And it's saying, according in the history that we have recorded this, at least from what they have, which is about the last 20 years, roughly, this is the largest gap that's existed. And that's where the too good to give up comes from.
I mean, I'm kind of flabbergasted that you're flabbergasted. I just have to come at you a little bit here. We've been talking about this for 2 years. I think this piece has cooler graphs.
You might be right. Maybe I shouldn't be as flabbergasted, because I definitely have completely internalized the fact that there's a significant portion of people that have low rates. I did not quite. Yeah, maybe it's the graphs that like maybe internalize it a bit differently, but I did not fully grok the full amount of pain that folks would take financially if they decided to buy today. I don't know why. Maybe your flabbergast is justified.
Yeah.
It does have cool graphs though. I'm gonna throw out a couple points here. For one, between 1998 and 2020, there was never a time when more than 40% of Americans with mortgages had locked in rates more than one percentage point below market conditions. By the end of 2023, about 70% of all mortgage holders had rates more than three percentage points below what the market would offer them. Locked in.
Yep.
They have these graphs. We'll share this on the Substack, skippydougals.substack.com, on Monday. We'll share this in the Substack so you can check out the graphs. But the graphs here, they've got this graph. It shows 99, 2005, 2011, 2019, and 2023. And the percentage of mortgage holders that have certain rates going from the graph, it goes from 2% to 10+%. And the shift is so dramatic in this. There were people above 10 percentage points in 99 and no one above 6%. I mean, like that shows up on the graph at least in 2023. So the lowest in 1999 becomes the highest in 2023. And according to some research that a professor from University of Illinois here says, looking at swapping out a new mortgage, it said if, on average, if folks sold their home and bought the same home today at current rates, the difference would be about $511 per month.
There's so many thoughts here. So one, when inflation spiked, we had to talk interest rates on the show. Like, we talked about that a lot. Do you remember the start of this year when the betting public was saying there was going to be something like 5 interest rate cuts? Like,
yeah,
how idiotic was that at the time? And this is not a podcast of predictions and forecasts, but we were like, this doesn't make any sense at the time. It doesn't make any sense today. Rates are higher for longer. Brilliant people like Howard Marks have said this. Jay Powell at the Fed has consistently said this. There's a reckoning that's going to have to come with these interest rates. Now, you've seen all the startups around assumable rate mortgages, right, Dougals? So that's one way that some of this gets taken care of.
I don't think I have seen those.
Okay. So yeah, you sell your home and your loan as a part of that package, so they're able to take over your 3% mortgage rather than refinance a 7% mortgage. Obviously, that's pretty complex. And there's a middleman involved that wants to make money on it.
Of course.
But other things that have to match up is like the remaining term on, you know.
Yeah.
I just think this is something that, one, real estate prices probably have to come down. Again, I'm not saying anything happens next week, but over the next 5 years, if the interest rate environment remains the same, the only way that you rectify that $500 per month gap is if prices come down.
You know what I enjoyed seeing this week was screaming headlines about stagflation because GDP numbers came out. Yeah. Now, if you go back 2 years ago, I can understand saying, like, is stagflation about to be in our future?
Uh-huh.
But people from the 1970s looking at us today about screaming about stagflation when inflation's at 3%. I'm not saying stagflation's not going to happen, right? We don't know. But they're going, okay, so your economy's growing at 2% and inflation's at 3%. And you are screaming about stagflation. Let me tell you about inflation over 10%. Like, it's just it's such a.
And your economy contracted. Yeah, let me jump in because we're bad at doing this. So if you don't know what stagflation is, it's when inflation is greater than the growth of your economy, basically GDP. So a really bad stagflation event might be inflation at 10% and an economy that's not growing at all. You're totally right that the freak out that happened for whatever 45 minutes this week was a little overblown. Because it effectively said inflation and GDP growth are about the same. You know, these quarterly readings are kind of junk anyway.
And this stuff is complex, so I am oversimplifying. But what happens is people scream about how there's going to be all the rate cuts. And a core reason why the Fed would want to cut rates quickly is because the economy starts to go south. That's a core reason. Then we show slower than expected growth in the economy. And people go, okay, now we got troubles. So, like, a core reason why the Fed would do what they want to do came about. And people got upset. The Fed's not going to cut rates because rates should, like, why not just cut rates today? Like, rates are at a normal range. So there would be some reason why the Fed would need to cut rates. Am I wrong?
You're not wrong, but it's so much more complicated than that. Basically, if inflation is persistent, then the Fed is not cutting rates. It doesn't matter what the economy, how challenged GDP growth is almost not relevant if inflation's at 10%. Because if inflation is running away, you can't, like, you're eroding everyone's wealth every minute of every day. So it's one of those, you have to have inflation under control before you can stimulate the economy with rate cuts. At least that's how I see it. And that's typically how, going back even to Volcker, the Fed will talk about this. I don't know. Am I oversimplifying?
Yeah. No. What you're saying is right. It's a weird place right now because inflation's not out of control. Inflation is above the place where we want to have it. Not out of control, but higher than we want. And maybe if I say the opposite version of what I said, it makes more sense. If GDP came out and it was growing at 6%, the Fed would never cut rate. Like that is not even a sign that inflation is going to come down because it means that there's a lot of spending that's happening. So that would not happen. We can't take the opposite and say that if it's below expectations that the Fed would cut, but it's an indicator at least that things might be heading in a direction that the Fed may in the future see an inflation reading that comes down because spending has gone down.
Sure.
And so it's an indicator that in the future, there's a thing that you want that may has a greater chance of occurring. That's maybe the way to put it. And people started screaming stagflation.
Yep.
Any hootie hoo. Mortgages.
What's in your fishbowl?
Too good to give up.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not giving mine up.
I'm going to continue on talking about credit cards and debt and whatnot, because why the heck not? So we talked about, you talked about get debt, you die, child. I talked about home ownership, too good to give up. The last thing we're going
to I just have to jump in there. I know you're trying to rile me up this morning to make some good show content. I didn't say get some debt, you die. I said I really like the framing of saying, anytime you take debt, you're sacrificing a part of your future. And if you sacrifice too much of your future, then, to use Kent's language here, hope begins to die. And that totally makes sense. This actually relates like to the Biden student loan stuff that's been going on for years and everything else. That it's hard to be optimistic about the American dream. And let's not even call it student loans. For anyone that's walking around with $100,000 plus of debt that doesn't relate directly to like the place you live. Because you're like, why do I have to? I don't get any pleasure from that. It's just the consumption that I already spent. And now I see 10 years of me like slowly pulling this back uphill with until no joy associated with that. Yeah.
Until you die.
So hope debt begins to die. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. Perfect. You take out debt, you die. So now I'm going to talk about credit cards. We've been discussing this, maybe me with a little more fervor, because I get fervorish sometimes. We've been discussing consumer debt for a while, and a narrative that's out there is, yeah, but lots of cash, and delinquencies, and charge-offs, which is what we're going to discuss here, had not shown anything that was alarming, I'd say, partially because of the amount of cash and some wage increases. Now some of that is potentially starting to change. It's showing a reversal of the trend that came from the 2020 cash. So charge, just a little definitions. Thank you for flagging me on stagflation. Charge-offs are when a credit card company has said, look, we have all these accounts and we do not believe that we are going to be able to collect the debts from those accounts. That is called a charge-off. Correct me if you have a better definition.
I think that's fair enough. The reason there's data on that is effectively they have to communicate to their shareholders what's reasonable to expect to get paid in the future. Because credit cards, like all financial instruments, are effectively a game of risk and return, and you have to take some risks to make a decent return.
There you go. There are a few companies we'll talk about in here, but Discover is the first one listed in this little tweet storm that this person has. Discover reported that their credit card charge-off percentage has gotten to almost 6%, 5.7% in Q1 of 2024, which you have to go back to 2012 and before that 2008 to see that level of rate. Also, about a year and a half ago, it looks like, that was in the 1% to 2% range.
Yeah, the slope of this curve is similar to what was happening in 2007, 2008, 2009, effectively. Now, it started at a higher place in like 08.
Yeah.
But of course it did. One, we wrote stimulus checks to everyone. So personal savings rates were like coming out of COVID were artificially inflated. And because of that, the consumer credit looked better than maybe you and I speculated it ever should in the most recent years. But now this is more than, let's just say this is a definite trend at this point.
Yeah. And a thing we talked about a couple years back was feeding off the concept that it's hard for human beings to comprehend compounding and exponential growth. What was happening then was people were saying, we got a bunch of cash, the labor market's turning in our direction, we can say screw you to our bosses, we're going to lie flat and leave work. We're going to work two jobs with mouse jigglers. Like, we're doing all this stuff out there. And we go, and debt is building up and interest rates are going to or had started increasing. And what that's going to do with your cash, you cannot comprehend at this moment. And like, that is the wall that potentially consumers could hit. This is what we were talking about a year and 2 years ago.
Uh-huh.
It seems like some version of that potentially is hitting. People are saving a lot less money.
Mm-hmm.
We discussed what interest rates look like in the credit card market. They have spiked to 20-something percent. I was looking at one of my credit cards the other day. I was just going to pay it off. It's like, oh my gosh, dag nab gee willikers. I think all those words came out. Like, if I did not pay this off, it's something, it was like 23 or 24%. I was like, wow, that is massive.
I mean, but that's part of the same thing. When someone like Discover sees their delinquencies going up, they increase their rates in a way that I think is predatory, but that's something for our government to fail at, I'm sure. I can't get you out of my head now. Next time, like today when I'm at the store swiping my credit card, I'm going to hear you echoing like, this debt will make you die.
Yeah, you said it. I'm just echoing what you said to me. The other graph that this shows is the Federal Reserve of Philadelphia. It comes out with a quarterly record of the 30 days past due balances in credit cards. Yep. And that is also taking it's not the same slope, but the same trajectory as this. So you have the charge-off rates from the credit card companies. It's not just Discover. We'll share this on the Substack, too. You can see that it's other banks with credit cards, too. And then you also show that the 30 days past due is also going in that same direction.
Are you scared? Are you scared yet?
I don't know if scared's the right word, but maybe it's accurate enough. It could, because for the last couple of years, even I've been discussing it and whatnot with you and always saying, but I hope it doesn't happen. We hadn't seen this happen yet. Spending was still strong. You know, I hope it doesn't happen. Now it looks like it's happening. Potentially. I still hope maybe this is it. Maybe it reverses course. Who knows? But it does not feel good. Let me say that. It does not feel good. And it also seems like it is going to be as it kind of, maybe not always, but as usually takes the course, it's going to be the folks in the lower income places that are going to get hit the hardest because cash still is very high. Cash balances are still quite high. And that indicates to me that the places where the cash is like a whole lot of people have a whole bunch of cash and cushion. And then there's a swath of people that can't pay their credit card bills that may have to sell their homes when they don't want to in order to get cash. There's a cascade effect that could happen. You got me going.
You've gone to crazy town here. You're like, you're five steps down the road in the apocalypse.
Yeah.
It has been interesting because we've had our eye on stuff like this for 2 or 3 years, and it's been a schizophrenic economy. There has been concerning numbers for the last several years, and so far it hasn't really taken hold in the stock market or even in real estate prices or other places, but it also can't last forever. We talk a lot about compounding and exponential growth on the show.
Yep.
Correct. Here's a fun way to say that I hadn't heard recently. This is from Meb Faber. He was hypothesizing that you can play with a famous Hemingway quote and have it reflect on basically how you grow wealth.
I like
so he says, how do you get rich? Two ways, gradually and then suddenly. His example here is if you manage to get 10% returns for 25 years, in the first 25 years, sorry, if you manage to get 10% returns for 50 years, the first 25 years, you 10x your money. But in the next 25 years, you 100x your money, right? It's the same. It goes back to all the Buffett calculators. Or 99% of Buffett's wealth came after his 50th birthday. Like, it's all this stuff that I think can be really hard to see if you're just the person putting 12% of your salary in your retirement account or putting $100 a week in your post-tax investing account. Like, you build and you build and you build, and sometimes it doesn't feel like it's moving the right direction. Well, that's because you're in that first 25-year period.
Yeah.
And so I just think it's such a good reminder that you almost have to develop a habit without seeing the instant reward, knowing that when your exponential growth hits down the road, that's when like it's mind-blowing amounts of money.
Yeah, exactly. I'll throw out a couple numbers just to bring this to life, because it's the absolute value of the number is also very important. If somebody has a retirement goal, let's say that's $1 million, and they have $100,000 in their retirement account.
Yeah.
And over some compounding years, you go, okay, so if I compound over a few years, and so I get 50% overall growth, I'll be at 150. I'm never going to get to retirement.
Yeah.
Right? Let's say that starting point was $500,000. Same compounding growth, but you say if I get to 750, and you're like, okay, I can see. Now, I can see the $1 million. But it's hard to see when you're at that early point. You're like, oh, my goodness, right? Because it would take 25 years to get to the $1 million. and you just don't see it. It's so hard to see. I wasn't planning on talking about this, so I don't have notes on it. But you just reminded me of something you also sent over this week about gamification, humans and games. And you said, I think you like this. And you was right. Yeah. I didn't think it was going to come up today. But I'll bring up one part of it. I'm doing it from memory, so I might mess this up. But I bring up one part of it. It talks about B.F. Skinner and how he did these experiments with pigeons. And he learned three things. He learned, one, I'll get them. These are not going to be in order.
Yeah.
But he learned three things. He learned that randomness is important with people being able to get rewards.
Now, this was he had different triggers on how the pigeons could get fed, correct?
Yeah, that's right.
And one was basically they push a button, food drops out. And what they found is they just push the button over and over because, of course, it's like the instant gratification thing.
Yep.
The other two, I'm bringing my memory back with this too, but the other two were push a button and you get delayed gratification. So food would pop out, but not instantaneous. And the third was basically the button was unrelated to the food delivery, correct?
Or it was random. It wasn't, you wouldn't get it every time. But right? So it was random. Yeah, that was exactly right. And the reason I bring this up, so it's immediate rewards are better than delayed. Unpredictable rewards are better than fixed. And then conditioned rewards work better. That means he separates the world into where you have like rewards that you're born liking some rewards, and then you're conditioned to like some rewards. And he said conditioned mm-hmm. rewards are stronger. The reason you reminded me of this is because in the world with the quote, the reverse Hemingway quote, whatever you just had, is because in the world of investing, you don't get the immediate reward. So like bad, that leads to bad behavior. You do get the unpredictable reward. And so it has both of those elements, it has one of those elements. So it's unpredictable rewards and people love it. It's like gambling. It feels good, but it's not immediate. And so sticking to the good behavior is hard, but you still want to do a thing because it's unpredictable. It has like these two contradictory levers with how the human psyche works. I hadn't put this into the investing world until you just brought that up.
Well, who knew that you were going to be throwing shade at all the Robinhood users trading 0-day options, because they're the pigeons that get the immediate reward. Yeah. Because what that does is that completely takes what's really important to grow true wealth, which is the long-term mindset, but it takes it out of the game and says, I want to make this gambling. A good point. I like that. Related. It's all related, really. What I did this week, and I'm, 20 plus years into my investing journey, right? But is I just pulled out all my accounts and did some breakdowns of basically passive income, usually through dividends, that's coming from all these different brokerage accounts I have. And that's a really fun exercise for me. You probably have to be 20 years in the game because you start to be like, oh, that's almost like the income of my first job or whatever, like you can kind of benchmark it and you can go, I see where I am on this journey and I can see the promised land. But to your point, doing that 2 years in is not going to feel like much. And doing that 40 years in is going to be like, oh my goodness, if you do this right, it's going to be like, I have more money coming in each year than I can even spend. And I don't know what to do with it. And now I just have to eat peanut brittle and drink Diet Coke. Like this is it's all there is the for me way. To do in life. Yeah.
It's the only way.
Do you have any exercises like that where you try and frame kind of where you are in the journey?
Yeah. Yeah, I do. For the reason that you're stating, because the absolute dollars end up becoming interesting relative to some of that other stuff. I think it was last year. I cannot remember why. The reason is probably because I do nerd stuff with money things. I think that's the only reason why. And I said, I want to go back and look at my income changes since I started working. And I couldn't do all of this like exactly, because I was like, let me see, when I worked at the supermarket, I was making, I had to like try and calculate certain things from way back in the day. But looking at that and thinking about what you said, it is interesting to look at the the income from like first jobs and what that relatively meant to me, and then what Broadcom pays in dividends right now. It is kind of wild, but it takes, to your point, this is over 20 years ago. Like it ends up taking that long. And I mean, I've only owned Broadcom for a few years, so it's not like that's not the point in Broadcom. Yeah. But it's just that. But the compounding that then led to that, it's super wild. But now it's so easy to understand.
Definitely. What else is in your fishbowl?
I am bone dry.
All right, I'm not gonna talk about it. It's a pretty long read, but I will mention it, and we'll put it in the show notes. There's a good piece by Rebecca Fang in the Wall Street Journal on the folly of China's real estate boom and the, building a world-class resort
ghost towns
for polo enthusiasts that no one was ever going to use. Evergrande valuing their parking spots at $20,000 per spot when the apartments that the parking spots supported were never going to be full. Like the kind of forensic accounting behind the scenes that identified as early as 2016 that this was a complete joke is very interesting. It's a good read. The funny piece about this is at some point, I think it was 2018, 2019. I was pretty confident based on my reading that the China real estate boom was fake, but there was no good trade, at least for me there wasn't. I didn't want to touch it with a 10-foot pole, and these people who were even on the ground, they still had to sit on their hands. When you're first identifying the issues in 2016 and things didn't really blow up. I mean, they're still blowing up kind of, but they blew up in the last 2 or 3 years broadly. It took 6 years. That goes back, I think this is Howard Marks again, but it could be Klarman, where it talks about the difference between being right and being too early. Well, being right and being too early is the same as being wrong, effectively.
Yep.
That's the hardest thing with some of this stuff. Sometimes when you're on the ground, you identify something just too far ahead of the mainstream money that is actually moving the markets.
And it costs money to short, short in these cases. You're paying money to do it.
Oh, yeah.
And so that also gets to the other quote that I'm going to mess up here around the market can stay irrational longer than you can stay solvent. One of those types of quotes. It's the timing matters so much. That's right. Early is wrong.
Yep. But read the piece if you're into it. Like, it's just great pictures, great reporting, fun to kind of go back through. Real estate's an amazing one because it has this fascination as a real asset where people love to invest in real estate, but it can just be nonsensical to build empty stuff. And for some reason, we seem to gravitate towards this.
We do love emptiness. I don't know. It's trying to be profound. All right, let's wrap it up.
You were not, but remember, debt steals your soul. So.
Not just death, but soul taking. Oh my goodness.
Perfect. We love listener mail. SkippyDougals@gmail.com for that. All thanks for the show. SkippyDougals.com. What am I missing, Dougals?
Be live from Omaha next week.
We'll be live.
Recorded from Omaha next week. We will be live. You will not hear us live.
But if you're a premium subscription, you can get near live content.
That's true.
Because you get the show early. That's right. SkippyDougals.supercast.com. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.